A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Welcome back to The Peripheral. Thank you to all my Patreon supporters and everyone who supports the show. On this week's episode, I speak with Rob, who is a dedicated father. He's diligent, organized, and would do anything in his power for his children. Rob finds himself being a foreigner in a foreign land. Living abroad anywhere is going to have its challenges. When the most terrible thing happens, your child becomes sick, all the inconveniences, all the different things that you have to overcome on a normal day become huge barriers. The lengths that Rob goes to for his daughter are astounding. All the second guessing, self-blame, and regrets that followed when all of his efforts could not prevent what ended up happening to him. Normally on many of these stories, I will edit them down to just get the story out. Rob has many asides, many additional things that happened to him while he was living abroad, and I felt they were absolutely necessary to paint a picture of his environment, to paint a picture of what he had to go through. I want to personally thank Rob for sharing his story with me. The time we spent talking was amazing, emotional, and I just can't say enough good things. I hope Rob the best. A big shout out to all the guests that I've had on the show thus far. It takes a lot of courage and bravery to share your story, no matter what it's about. They're really the ones that are this show. I feel I just give them a place to tell their story.
So was I wrong or am I right? Is this like the most prepared podcast you've ever had before?
Yeah, this is the most prepared.
I just thought it'd make it easier. I mean, I don't know what you want to touch on.
But yeah, this is a crazy story, and I don't know anything about living abroad. Do you want to just introduce yourself and where you're at now?
Okay. Yeah, my name's Rob. I lived in China for 10 years. From 2002 to 2012. I used to live in upstate New York and have currently returned to upstate New York. I probably would still be in China, except that my wife and I, we had a daughter named Annie who passed away July of 2012. And the story around her passing away is perhaps a little bit interesting or even disturbing at some level. And I just wanted to try to share her story with some people. And I contacted Justin to see if he was willing to do it, and we decided to give it a try.
You moved to China so many years back. I don't know why you would move there, but you did have your wife out there. So what all were the reasons for you moving out there?
Well, actually, I was married in America to an American, and we had a separation. And it was extremely nasty. For example, she, you know, called in child abuse reports on me, things like that, that were unfounded just to try to make my life miserable. I used to run my own business, so this was sort of a problem. But basically, it just got to the point where the best thing for me to do was just to go, which I did. I did have two children with her. You know, if I could have gone to Mars or something like that, if they sold an airplane ticket to Mars, I would have gone there. But China was the farthest away I could go. So basically, I packed up two bags and $50,000, which is all that I had, and went to China without knowing how to speak the language, not really knowing anybody there. Gave it a shot. That's where I ended up in July of 2002. So I lived in China for many years. I taught, I was in IT before I went to China. Mm-hmm. When I went to China, I taught English, which is what a lot of people do when they go overseas. So I taught English for several years and then ended up actually going back into IT. I met my current wife in 2007. My divorce had already finalized at that point. So we ended up finding out that we had a baby due in January of 2009, and we got married in May of 2009.
I'm sure the culture shock of moving out there, I mean, I'm sure that finding a job, all that was pretty scary. Was it nice when you finally met your wife and had somebody to go through this with?
Well, I'm a pretty sociable person. I make friends really easy. I don't usually get too stressed out about being in an unfamiliar environment. So, you know, China was a lot of fun. It was super interesting. It was new, just about something new every day, some good things, some bad things, but new every day. Mm-hmm. And I really did enjoy it. Plus, you know, when back in those days, early 2000s, a foreigner in China was sort of like a special event. Like, for example, if I would eat at a restaurant, let's say I'd be sitting by the window and the sidewalk is outside and I'm eating some food in the restaurant. Now, this is back in the early 2000s. I don't think it happens anymore. But there would be a crowd of people outside watching me eat food. That's the way it was when I was over there.
That's so weird.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so you got a lot of attention. A lot of people wanted to make friends with you. So it was pretty easy. And I lived in a place called Nanjing in China, which was a college town. There was a lot of universities there. So there was a lot of people that spoke English. So it was pretty easy to live there. This is, of course, back in the 2000s. You can get a furnished apartment, maybe 800 square foot, 700 square foot on the 33rd floor of a high rise, fully furnished for $250 a month.
Oh, wow.
So the cost of living is very low. Fantastic food. I mean, food in an American Chinese restaurant is nothing like food in the worst real Chinese restaurant in China. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like this. Like, if you go, I mean, do you think a McDonald's hamburger is a real hamburger?
No.
And right. Yeah. And that's exactly how it is in China. You know, I mean, if you think that some Chinese food that you get at a Chinese restaurant in America is real Chinese food, it's the same kind of comparison. There's none. I did not return to America for 10 years. I did go to Japan and Korea and Hong Kong during that time because I had to renew my visa during those 10 years. It was quite the culture shock when I came back. Now, in China, I especially, you know, in later years, so in 2009, when my wife and I got married and we bought a house, which was actually, you know, there really is no houses in China. They're generally apartment buildings. So we had an apartment, which is on the 5th and 6th floor of an apartment building. You know, when you buy a house in China, it's just bare concrete walls, no plumbing, no electric, nothing, no flooring. So I redid the whole house in an American style. With like no Chinese characteristics at all. So it was sort of like my little American cave in China. Sort of gave me some security and peace of mind. Mm-hmm. After my daughter passed away, who was about 2 3/4 years old when she passed away in China, my wife and I really haven't been back to that house. We've pretty much abandoned it at this point.
Did you sell it or just...
No, well, what happened is after she passed away, you know, which was unexpected, we didn't know. It all took 30 days from the beginning to the end. And those 30 days we were in, you know, at hospitals and so on the whole time. You know, my wife was a basket case, of course, and I put everything that was Annie's stuff into her room and locked the door. You know, every crayon, every, you know, little toy, coloring book, you know, everything was just put into a room and locked up. And that's how it is still today, 5 years later.
Was Annie showing any signs or symptoms of trouble before, like months or weeks before?
Well, she actually passed away in, it would have been like about the 2nd of, well, she had her stroke on the 2nd of July, 2012. But she started getting leg pain and arm pain, in like November of 2011. And she also started getting some rashes. So of course we're in China. So we contact, you know, we go to the hospitals there, the local hospital. My wife had an aunt that was a sort of like a pediatrician style doctor, called her on the phone. And they pretty much said that, you know, these pains were related to growing, like growing pains. And that the rashes were probably related to, you know, a food allergy or something like that. So it did start, you know, about 8 months before she actually passed. And it just progressively got worse and worse. But yeah, that was, we didn't really know how serious it was until probably 2 days before she passed away. We thought it was just an infection.
You see a pediatrician first. It doesn't improve. Now you're having to take her to hospitals.
You know, the healthcare in China is a little crazy. So let me just go into this a bit. There's really no doctor's office. It's all done through the hospital. So, you know, if you have a problem, you go to the hospital. You don't make an appointment. If it's an emergency room thing, of course you go to the emergency room at the hospital. But if you want to see a regular doctor, you just go to the hospital and go to their office. Because of this, you're going to see a different doctor each time, and there's no continuity of care. So, you know, if you have a problem on Tuesday and you see Dr. Wang on Tuesday, you might see Dr. Chen on Wednesday, and they have no idea who you are or anything about your case. You do carry around a book, a hospital book, which they put notes in. But my general experience is that one doctor can't read the other doctor's notes. So it's pretty worthless. The other sort of strange thing about healthcare in China is that when you go see the doctor, it's not in a private situation. So what happens is you walk into the room where the doctor is, and there might be four or five other people or families or patients waiting around his desk. You wait in line right in the room. So you can hear everything that the current patient is explaining or discussing with the doctor. You know, you see other people have like their ears cocked trying to hear every little detail. So there's no privacy at all, which is totally different from America. The cost is really low. I mean, to see a doctor can run anywhere from 50 cents to $3, basically. But you really have no idea what their qualifications are. I mean, they don't have anything posted on the wall. You don't know anything about these people. In the beginning, when Annie got sick or started having these problems, we would take her to the local hospital and they would, you know, do their thing. And they would generally prescribe an antibiotic or possibly give her an IV. IVs are a big thing in China. You get an IV for everything. You know, they think you have a cold, you get an IV. You have a hangover, you get an IV. You have a stubbed toe, you get an IV. Now, I know I'm exaggerating to a certain extent, but IVs are a big business in China. That's how they treat you.
That's just step one in treatment.
Right. They go right to IV. They go right to an antibiotic. Yes, in the beginning, you know, around Christmas and into the early, you know, the spring of 2012, we would go to the local hospital. They would pretty much say, you know, she has an infection. Here's an antibiotic. You know, take some Tylenol, that kind of stuff for her fevers. They would do like a CBC or general blood work. So like no tests for like rheumatoid arthritis or anything like that. No antibody testing, nothing like that. But as I mentioned, my wife knew an aunt. Now, when I say aunt in China, you have to understand it doesn't mean a real aunt. That just means a family friend.
Okay.
Okay. No, so no my relation. Brother, yeah. I might call you my brother, but you're not really my brother. You're just a close friend. So she had an aunt that was a pediatric nurse, and they would discuss on the phone. And pretty much the attitude was that Annie's pain was from growing pains. She was a pretty tall kid. So, you know, it sort of made sense. So what happened is that, you know, we constantly were battling with these fevers and rashes that covered her entire body. So when I was over in China, I started listening to a lot of religious podcasts and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I never really had a history of being very religious, you know, to any extent. And I got pretty much, you know, to the born again level, mm-hmm. where I thought that, you know, my sins were forgiven, my past sins, that, you know, that it was God against the devil. You know, in China, there's very little moral compass of the Chinese people, very little. So when I was over there, probably part of the reason that I went to this extent of listening to a lot of sermons and trying to find some guidance in my life as far as how I was going to present myself to the world. It was because I continuously every day ran into people that I just thought had no level of moral compass or the golden rule or treat others like you wish that they would treat you or anything like that. I used to listen to Timothy Keller and Mark Driscoll. Some people might have heard of these people before. Very close to the time that Annie really started to get bad, probably. So this would have been in May or early June. I was out on my patio and I said a prayer that more or less said to the devil and to God that I would work with God to do everything that I could do to take the devil down in China, because I really felt there was a lot of evil in China. And there's stories I can go into about that, but that's what I said.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, within the next hour, Annie had her worst attack ever. We took her to the local hospital, and they treated her again for having an infection. After she was at the local hospital for the infection, that was done outpatient, she came home, and she continued to have a lot of fevers, rashes, pain. So we were going to have to go to another hospital. So we were at the local hospital. Now we were going to go to the county seat hospital, which is in Yantai. And it's about an hour away. You know, I had to go to the bank and take some money out and stuff like that. And as I was walking down the street, I fell into a manhole up to my armpits.
How has that happened? That seems just crazy thing to happen right now.
It was bizarre. It was just like, you know, I fell into this manhole up to my armpits. My shoes came off, fell down into the manhole. Luckily, I didn't fall in. Nobody helped me. I pulled myself out. I went into the place that the manhole was in front of. They wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't give me any help. And so that was just a crazy occurrence.
But I've seen video of people walking across the street or on like a scooter and then a car hits them. And then they're in the middle of the street laying there dying. Hundreds of people will just go around them and their bleeding body. And it just seems incredible to me that nobody wants to help.
Well, that's sort of what happened with me. I wanted to know, well, with the manhole, the cover was on it. And when I stepped on it, it flipped over. Okay. It was a round cover, but it like flipped.
Yeah.
And that's how I fell in. But when I went into the establishment that was, you know, in front of the sidewalk where the manhole was. And I wanted to know, you know, first off, could somebody help me get my shoes out of there? And second off, you know, who owns this building? Who's responsible for this? Whatever. They didn't want to talk to me. They didn't care. And I actually called the police. The police came and said they could do nothing about it. Needless to say, I mean, I was pretty disgusted, but I had been through a lot of other things there too. So, you know, when I mentioned before about, you know, being in China in the beginning, where a foreigner was back in 2002, 2003, 2004, where a foreigner was sort of, you know, held up or respected, or at least, something that was
exotic and kind of sought after.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. By the time 2011, 2012 rolled around, China had changed a lot. There's a lot more nationalism in China. There's a lot more instances of foreigners, you know, doing crazy things, coming to China and causing damage to the, you know, going against cultural norms, things like that. And the other weird thing that happened is that, you know, we had a fish tank that had, it was like 12, 15 Chinese goldfish in it. So this fish tank was about 250 gallons, and I took care of it quite well by my front door. All these fish in one night all died. Now you have to understand, this was really bizarre because the fish in our house, was a sign of success, a sign of healthiness, a sign of prosperity. And to have all the fish die in one night was shocking.
And it's like a sign of bad luck.
Exactly. So then, you know, we ended up going to Yantai. And this is in the beginning of June, so the month before Annie passed away, 2012. And she was there for about 2 weeks, actually two separate visits, where she received antibiotics. As far as I know, there was no culture done, no blood culture done. There was really no testing. It was pretty much let's give it a shot. Let's try this antibiotic. We continued on to the third hospital, which was in Qingdao. But let me take a little break a little bit and explain to you a little bit about hospitalization in China, how it works.
In the payment process, because that seemed very odd to me.
Sure. Well, the thing is that in China, when you go to the hospital, you need to pay for everything before you receive the service. So they're basically not going to do anything for you unless you've paid for it. So let's say that you need to have, you need an IV and you need a bag with the medication in it. Either you or a family member has to go down to the pharmacy, find out what the cost is for the medication, for the tubing and so on. Go to the cashier's desk, wait in line at the cashier's desk usually, pay that money, go back to the pharmacy, pick up the medicine and bring the medicine and the tubing up to the room yourself. So if you are admitted to a hospital in China and you don't have family, you're basically screwed because you would have to be the one that would have to run around everywhere to do all these things. If you need a CAT scan, if you need an X-ray, if you need any procedure done, it all has to be paid for ahead of time. Now, in some cases, you can put down a large deposit, which will make it easier.
Like a credit line.
Right. Yeah. But, so you can put down, like, for example, when we did that, when we were in Beijing, we started off with 10,000 RMB deposit, which was about $2,000, just to make things easier. And we would just constantly refill that. And the nurse in China is not there for you. The nurse is there for the doctor. The nurse will do the procedures that need to be done. But, you don't call the nurse and ask for water. The nurse isn't going to come up and pull you up on the bed. They're not going to fix your bed. They're not going to fluff your pillow for you. They're not going to do any of that. That's not their job. That's the family's job. In fact, the bed has no blanket usually, or just a very thin one. No pillow for sure. So if you want a pillow, you got to bring your own. There's no food provided. Somebody has to go down and get your food for you and bring it to your room.
It seems incredible. If you were bleeding and dying in the street, would you just end up dying in the hospital because you wouldn't have a way to pay because you're unconscious or whatever?
Well, I have a story I can tell you. This is back when I was in Nanjing in 2000. This is probably like around 2004 or so. And I came down with bronchitis or, possibly pneumonia. I'm not sure. And I went to the hospital with a friend of mine. And they, of course, what did they prescribe to me? An IV, right?
Yeah,
so
of course.
I was sitting in the room with my friend receiving this IV. It was penicillin, and I had never had a reaction to penicillin in my whole life. But as I was sitting there getting this IV in the IV room, which is just a bunch of chairs and people sitting in them and you get your IV, I nodded out or passed out or whatever you want to call it. And my friend, thank God, reached over and just pulled the IV site right out of my arm, just yanked it right out. So, of course, they, screamed for the nurse. Of course, I'm out. I just heard this afterwards. But, they bought a gurney in, put me on the gurney, brought me to the emergency room. I guess they gave me some oxygen. And I woke up and I was looking at a nurse when I woke up. And I said, what happened? And they said, my Chinese, I could understand enough. They said, you passed out. And I said, oh. And then the next thing they said is, you need to pay the bill.
That's all that matters to them is
right.
Yeah.
Right. So, it's like I literally got handed the bill. And even though I had been, just seconds ago before passed out, the big problem at that point was that I had to go to the cashier, pay the bill.
Because if you died, they'd be left with the cost of this. So you have to pay this bill, right? It just makes sense. Jeez.
So it does show that they will do something in an emergency situation if needed, but they're pretty worried about the bill. And I guess American hospitals are the same way, but they're maybe not so blatant about it.
But if your friend hadn't pulled the IV out and you had died there.
Yeah, there was nobody watching the room. There was no supervision. Mm-hmm. So, that's just another example that you really need to have somebody with you.
So you're there with your daughter and you're having to run downstairs, make these payments for every little thing, and your daughter's having all these issues. I can't even imagine in a stressful situation having to deal with the bureaucracy and red tape of it all.
And there's really long lines now, and in Yantai, first off, the hospital in my hometown, can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, you can swear all you want.
Okay. So the hospital in my hometown was the dirtiest shithole that I've ever been in my life in a medical facility. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just unbelievable. The hospital in Yantai that Annie was at in the beginning of June, pretty much, you know, the beginning of her 30-day cycle, was a lot better. But, you know, the thing is that they really didn't take any steps to really find out what was wrong with her. You know, that was sort of the frustrating part of it all, was that, you know, oh, it's an infection. Here's another antibiotic. Oh, that doesn't work. Let's try a stronger one. Mm-hmm. You know, with no blood cultures, no real lab workups. I mean, I don't even know if they know how to do that or not. And I have some proof of that from a later experience. But so when we were in Yantai, you know, it was just the biggest frustration was, you know, we were out in the hallway on a stretcher with a whole bunch of other kids and just having to, you know, wait around with Annie, you know, for 10 or 12 days or whatever it was while she received IVs every day. You know, we really weren't worried at that point about her. We didn't think that she was really that sick. We were just, you know, we just thought that, you know, oh, she has a bad infection. She's going to get better.
Or she's having, you know, a reaction to something.
Yeah. Or something. Yeah. Some seafood, you know, she liked seafood. You know, I mean, you have to remember too, in China, there's a lot of problems with the food. You know, there's things like fake eggs or rice that's made out of plastic that looks just like rice. And you don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that we ever bought this stuff, obviously. You know, there's meat that's treated with chemicals that, especially pork, has a lot of adulterations in it. You know, I'll tell you a story. There was a gentleman that was a medicine salesperson, you know, for a medicine provider. His product was blood plasma, which is very expensive, okay? But it's used for people that have burns or, you know, very severe kinds of, like, injuries. And it was discovered that for a period of a little bit less than a year, he was selling colored water with plasticizer. What? Instead of the blood plasma.
Wouldn't that kill people?
Either kill them or certainly wouldn't give them the treatment that they needed. And, you know, this is one time that the Chinese government stepped up, because when he was discovered and convicted of this, they killed him. He was executed. So one of the things in China is that, you know, as far as there being a reaction to something like that. So, you know, does Annie have an infection? We don't really know. As far as it being a reaction to some food or the water or even the air where we lived in. So in our hometown, there was, you know, a couple coal generation plants. And we pretty much lived upstream from that as far as the way that the air blew. But, you know, you could see this, you know, horrendous smoke coming out of these things. And you would wonder, you know, and I think everybody's seen recently the air in Beijing. Oh, and yeah. All the talk about pollution in China. And, you know, there's some data that, you know, like I said, I don't have a reference for this, but I know you can find it if you look, that, you know, this pollution contributes to, you know, 100,000 or 50,000 or whatever deaths a year in China just due to the pollution. I mean, one of the things that when I brought my wife back to America for the first time and she got off the plane, and this is in Newark, New Jersey, okay? And she stepped out, you know, out of the airport.
Yeah.
And she was like, my God, the air's so clean. And this is in Newark.
This isn't a place where I would think the air is clean. Yeah.
Right. You know, I've been back to China a few times since my daughter passed away. And, you know, we would just get off the airplane in China after living in America. And we're like, wow, this just, like, it smells like gasoline.
Just chemicals.
Right. So, you know, as far as Annie having problems because of a reaction to something, you know, it certainly, you know, it entered our mind, and we tried to buy the best food that we could. And, you know, I was a baker at that point. I used to bake a lot of my own bread and things like that at home. But, you know, that was certainly, you know, it made sense to us. It made sense. She had growing pains. So she had pains in her knees and in her elbows. It made sense to us that her rashes were from a reaction. You know, she was a blonde, light-skinned girl. And, you know, sometimes people that are like that tend to, you know, they can react to things. That made sense. The fevers, okay, she has an infection. She has a bad cold. It all made sense. We thought, you know, this is something that we'll get through. This isn't a big deal. But after the 2 weeks in Yantai, and this is the middle of June 2012.
You have no idea what's wrong with her.
No, we don't.
And nobody else does either.
It just continued. So my wife is like, let's go to Qingdao. So Qingdao is a bigger, is like the, you know, one of the biggest cities in the province that we lived in, you know, like the state. We had a driver. I didn't own a car at that point, but we just had a driver with a car that he would provide and checked into the hospital at Qingdao. So when we got to Qingdao, they were a little bit more thorough. They did some blood tests and Annie's white blood cell count. And this is the first time we really heard this. We didn't hear this in Yantai or in the local hospital, was greater than 30, which is very high for a white blood cell count. And she also had a very elevated thing called a SED rate, which is a sedimentation rate. So what that means is they put your blood into a container, into a test tube that's marked with like millimeters. So they put a certain amount of blood in there and they let it sit. And they see how much sediment, more or less, is in your blood. And she had excessive sediment in her blood. So dead blood cells, proteins, things like that. The doctor in Qingdao at first thought that she had something called Kawasaki disease. Kawasaki disease is the reason for it is unknown, but it does cause, you know, these lab results. But it has a sign to it, which is a bright strawberry colored tongue. And Annie didn't have that. And I questioned him about that to a certain extent, but he decided to treat her for that anyways. So what he ended up giving her was interferon. So interferon is like a...
That's harsh. That's like chemotherapy almost, right?
Pretty much, yeah. A whole bunch of steroids, obviously Tylenol, antibiotics, things like that. So she continued to deteriorate. I mean, we were there, I don't know, about 7 days or so. So this is the end of the month in June of 2012. And, you know, we just felt like, you know, she wasn't getting better. They seemed confused, unsure of what was going on. So my wife said, we need to give him a red bag.
What exactly is a red bag?
Okay, so a red bag is a bribe. This is pretty common in China for a lot of things, and it's pretty common in the healthcare industry. So what that means is that you basically, you literally put it into a red bag, a red plastic bag, a red paper bag, preferably. That's the custom.
Yeah, yeah.
And you present this to your doctor or healthcare professionals so that they give your case more attention. Now, this is discouraged by the Chinese government, and they've been trying to get doctors to stop doing this, but it still exists. So I went with my wife, and we offered the doctor 10,000 RMB, which is about $1,500 in the red bag. And he refused it. So, of course, you know, in China, in a lot of cultures, it's like, please take this. No, I don't want it. Please take this. No, I don't want it. Please take this. No, I don't want it. You know, then you put it in their pocket, you know, and then they take it out of their pocket. And then you, there's just like this game that goes back and forth where you try to get somebody to take one of these things.
Yeah. It's like a weird ritual of them.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of them sort of covering their ass of, I'm not taking a bribe, but you're forcing me to take it, or I would never do this because I'm a good person. I also heard that they will give you misinformation to appease you. Say, oh, well, I've changed your flight for this airplane, even though they haven't, just to make you feel good and go away. And then when you go to the other flight, there's no change and you're stuck and stranded. Like it's very appeasing and non-confrontational. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, here's my general thing about that with a confrontation in China. Just a quick story is, so I had an apartment and I was going to be leaving this apartment. Of course, the landlord wanted to bring people over to see it, right? To possibly rent the apartment. So I told him, I said, you know, you can come after 8 o'clock at night, you know, between 8 and 10 at night, that's fine. But he kept on coming at all hours of the day. You know, sometimes I'm in the bathroom, I'm not dressed, whatever.
Yeah.
So I kept on telling him, please don't do this, right? So one day that he brought somebody over, somebody knocked on the door. I opened the door. It's him standing there with a tenant. And I basically said, Gwen, which means piss off in Chinese. And, you know, which is a pretty strong word to use to somebody that you know.
Especially your landlord.
Right. And slammed the door in his face. Okay. The thing is that now it became about what I did, what my response was to him, because I didn't give him face with his tenant, his new tenant. Didn't make any difference that he came, you know, at a time that he shouldn't have come and I wasn't ready for it and didn't know. that made no difference at all. Which, and that's how it is in China with confrontations on a lot of different levels.
And that's just the way their culture works. So I get it. I don't really agree with it, but I get it.
No, and the same thing's true even with my marriage, with my wife. She can do something wrong that I think is wrong. I can react to it the wrong way, and then it doesn't matter because I reacted to it the wrong way. The initial issue doesn't make any difference at all. So, but as far as the red bag stuff is concerned, so, you know, we tried to get him to take this. He wouldn't take it. You know, there was talk about giving more, you know, but we didn't even have enough time to process that before Annie really went downhill really quickly. So what they did is they added in IV aspirin to her treatment, which is also used for severe inflammatory disorders. Mm-hmm. And there was some talk of, you know, that we need to take her to a different hospital. We approached the doctor and said, we're going to take her to the best baby hospital in Beijing, children's hospital in Beijing. He really didn't agree with it very much, but he did, you know, sign off on it. And of course, we wanted to fly from Qingdao to Beijing directly, but my luck, there was no flights available.
Jeez.
So what we did is we called our driver again. He picked us up in Qingdao and we drove back to our house in Lunkou, about 3 hours.
You've gone a couple weeks now already, doctors to doctors to hospitals, and now you're having to drive over 3 hours.
Well, back to our house in Lunkou so that we can gather some money, things like that, and then go to the airport near our house to fly to Beijing. So we have this really sick kid, okay, who needs to go to a better hospital, but there's no flight available from Qingdao to Beijing. So we had to drive in a car from Qingdao to our home and then fly from our home airport to Beijing. Of course, when we got home, Annie was home and she was so happy. She had been in the hospital for a month now. She hadn't been home. She, you know, went onto her bed and was so happy. She didn't want to leave. She, you know, she was peaceful. She didn't want to go, but we're like, Annie, you got to go. We're leaving in another 2 hours. We're only home for 2 hours. We're here to get, you know, clothes and money and documents because we're going to Beijing and that kind of stuff. And we're not staying. And she totally disagreed with that. But we forced her to get into the car again and drive about another hour and 15 minutes to the local airport to take the flight to Beijing.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's had IVs in her arm, people sticking her in this cold, bad place. And now she's finally got the comfort of her room, of her bed. She doesn't understand.
Yeah, and she had more than that. She had her cats. We had four cats, which might seem weird, but we had, you know, a Garfield kind of like cat. And we had a mother cat who we had boarded at one time, and she got pregnant by mistake. This mother had a couple babies. We ended up keeping two of them. So that's where we got the four cats. We had a big apartment, a big house. And we had guinea pigs. My daughter and I used to raise guinea pigs. So we had anywhere from 5 to 15 guinea pigs at a time. And we would raise guinea pigs, of course, not for food. We would take them to the local night market or whatever, and people would buy them as pets. And we would, you know, instruct them how to take care of them and that they needed, you know, citrus, and because guinea pigs need vitamin C and all those. You know, we would try to do a good job. But, you know, my daughter really enjoyed that. And of course, we did have fish, but they're gone. And we had birds, and we had all kinds of animals. So she was happy to be home because she loved her animals. Now, the reason I even bring that up is that us having all these animals was considered to be dangerous in China. And so in America, if somebody had, I know four cats is a lot, I understand, okay?
Not really.
Yeah, but, you know, if somebody in America has a guinea pig or two and a fish and some fish and maybe a bird and, you know, a cat or a couple cats and that kind of stuff in America, that's, you know, not really, you know, as long as you wash your hands and things like that, you know, it's not considered to be dangerous. But in China, it's considered to be eccentric or frowned upon or dangerous or whatever.
And animals are considered dirty, probably.
Exactly. Right. Animals are not really considered to be something that children should be around or sleeping with or so. And, you know, and even like to the extent, and I'll get into this later, is the extent of, we had a sandbox. So, you know, we had two floors, we have a patio, and, you know, we're living in the city. So the second patio, you know, I had a whole bunch of plants on it. You know, it was very beautiful, and a big sandbox, like at least 10 by 10 foot sandbox. That was also something that people were like, you know, why do you have a sandbox? You know, that's weird. Where in America, a lot of Americans would be, that's a normal thing for a kid to play in the sand. It helps with their developmental, you know, aspects. But, you know, we went and we got on the plane and flew to Beijing. And
this is the number one children's hospital in a big city, supposed to be
the capital of China, right?
Yeah, supposed to be a great place.
Right. You know, I got off the, you know, I mean, we're all really tired. I'm hungry. You know, we get off the flight in Beijing. We're walking to the airport. There's a Starbucks there. So I got a coffee, I think, to go and a sandwich or something. It took an extra 5 minutes, but later on I would regret that. So we take the taxi and we, you know, we're pretty hopeful. You know, we're happy to be in Beijing. We're like, we're finally going to get the help, the answers we need, find out what's wrong with her. It's raining. And we pull up and we get dropped off and we go inside and it's like a zoo. You have to take a number, and this is before any triage, and we were number 60, where there's 60 people in front of us.
And there's no telling how long one person takes. It's either 5 minutes or 2 hours.
Yeah, there's no idea. And, you know, we had talked to some people there, how long you've been here for, and they're like, you know, it was hours, and, you know, I don't think anybody said a day, but, you know, it was like 6-8 hours, things like this. So, okay, so that's fine. I mean, that's not too bad, but there's no place to wait. So we had to wait outside in the rain.
Do they even have like structures out there to sit under, or are you just on the side of the street?
No, we're under an awning. We did find some room under an awning, and there's a little store there where you can buy, you know, like those little playground mats you can put in your house, mm-hmm. They interlock together. So that was the business, you know, that was the business model, is that, you know, people wait outside, they go to the little store that the hospital runs and they buy the mats and you sit outside. It's raining out. We weren't being dripped on per se, but it was damp and cold and not ideal for a sick child.
That just sounds horrible and cold.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. It was, you know, and then she's, you know, moaning and groaning and she's, you know, she's not well. So, you know, we're outside and so I'm there with myself, my wife, my mother-in-law and Annie. So I told them, I said, I'm going to leave for a minute. I'm going to go inside and try to find a place, someplace inside we can sit inside. So I left them and I was gone 5 minutes or something. And I was actually able to find some place that we could sit inside, a free spot. But we had to be really quick and get there or somebody would take it. So I came back outside and they're gone. They're not there. So I'm like, you know, where are they? I don't know.
You just left for a few minutes to find a place and now they're gone. And it's scary as hell because you don't know something's happened, if somebody's taken them or whatever the situation is.
Right. So I go back inside and I start searching around. And then, you know, somehow, I can't remember how, I found out that she's in the pediatric emergency room. So I'm able to get into there. It turns out that when I left, she had a seizure and I guess stroked out. You know, at this point, you know, I see her, she has oxygen on, you know, twisted up a little bit, not normal. And she's laying on the bed and the doctor's like, this isn't good. So, of course, I had to go through the pay thing first.
Your daughter's on the brink of death and you're having to run downstairs and pay.
Exactly. Go to the cashier, go to the pharmacy, run around, bring the stuff back, do all that. You know, they get her IV set up and all the other stuff that needed to happen. And, you know, they tell us that she needs to have a CT scan to find out what's going on in her head. So in China, this is normal. You know, I had to pick her up, carry her in my arms to the CT room.
No gurney.
And that's
no gurney. No wheeling her.
No, you know, and I've experienced this before in China. This is why I say you really need to have family. So, I mean, I wasn't really shocked by the CT scan thing, but I was questioning, what am I doing here in this country? Mm-hmm. She did the CT scan and came back And they said, you know, that she had had a stroke and she needed to go up to the pediatric intensive care unit upstairs. So once again, that kicks off the payment thing, run around, blah, 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 blah. So she gets sent up to the intensive care unit on the second floor. We had a locked door. We have no access. We can't see her. We're not allowed in.
So you have to sit outside.
Right, in the waiting room. So, of course, as you sit in the waiting room, or I sat in the waiting room, I start thinking about all this stuff. And I start getting really pissed off. You know, waiting in the rain, not having triage, just the dirtiness, the general scumminess of it all, on every level, starting from our city to the hospital in Yantai, to the hospital in Qingdao, to this the best children's hospital in China. She's in behind this locked door, and it's still late at night. Because we had gotten to Beijing at midnight. So it was, you know, in the middle of the night in the rain, we were outside. So this was like, you know, I don't know, I think it was like 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, where I had to vent. You know, I called my friends, but then I went outside into the courtyard. And, you know, my Chinese at that time was halfway decent. And I yelled at the top of my lungs, "You motherfuckers."
Because you're fighting against an ocean of shit.
It was just like, and actually I had to take a break but it was like, "You motherfuckers." I'm sure if I was the boss of this hospital, I wouldn't have had to wait with my daughter. You know, some things like this, you know, how can you let children wait in the rain? How can you, you know, basically these kinds of things. And I just like swore a lot, yelled a lot. I just had to get it out. And of course the security guard comes over and tells me to stop. And I'm like, you know, "Go fuck yourself. I'll do what I want." And I did it for 10 minutes. And then I realized, you know what, it's not going to make any difference anyways. And I stopped, went back inside.
I'm in utter disbelief of how this is acceptable. But then again, I can think of how my mother was in the hospital for the last 2 months and what was considered acceptable and not acceptable there. It wasn't nearly on the level of this, but, you know, my mom had a broken shoulder, fell and broke her hip a month later. You know, they had to use two orderlies and a nurse to get her up on a bedpan. And after 3 days, they discharge her. So leaves my sister and I scrambling to find a nursing home, a physical therapy place to put her in. Otherwise, they just would have sent her home after 3 days with a broken shoulder and a broken hip.
You know, it just goes to show you a little bit of the different attitude that there is.
Yeah.
So, you know, Annie's in the pediatric intensive care unit. I had already gone outside and done my little venting thing, trying to console my wife and my mother-in-law. And at this point, my wife's aunt had come also. So she had come on a later flight. And, you know, we were there about a day or so. I think we were allowed in to see Annie one time for 5 minutes during that time. But then they came out and they told us in the waiting room, in front of everybody, not in private, "She's brain dead.
No brain activity."
No. First off, do you do that in a public waiting room with everybody with their little ears cocked? You know, basically, when the doctor comes out, moving closer so they can hear. That's the way it is. Okay? Just a total lack of privacy. Second off, very bluntly, which is, I guess, appropriate. But once that happened, once those words were mentioned, it was surreal. My mother-in-law and my wife and my aunt literally ran at full speed into the walls, threw themselves down onto the floor, you know, their heads, banging their heads into the floor.
I mean, that's
trying to jump out the windows.
This is a very extreme reaction. Not that losing a child or knowing that your child's brain dead doesn't constitute a horrible reaction, but this is not
just
something you were ready for.
No, I didn't expect this. So, of course, I couldn't even process it myself because I was trying to keep people from, you know, literally jumping out of the window. I mean, I'm not joking. Opening the window, putting their leg up on the sill. I mean, punching themselves in the face, screaming, yelling. I understand the pain. I mean, I was there. I experienced it. I know also, but it was just like, you know, you really needed to say this in a public place with a lot of people around and maybe not sort of preface it with something, a little bit of hope or something. I don't know. It was just crazy. You know, I got everybody calmed down. You know, we moved on to the next part, which was dealing with that.
You find out she's brain dead. Your wife and her family react in a way that you've never seen a human react before. Is that normal for Asian culture to wail and freak out with grief?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've been around a couple funerals and things like that in China. I'll just tell you, you know, for all these people out there that might be dating a Chinese or something, never give anybody white flowers, because that's a death flower in China. No, the wailing I expected. That's fine. It was the concrete pillars in the room, people smashing their heads against them. You know, I mean, it was just, I've never experienced anything like that before. And it was just, it was one of the many things that happened with this where I was not allowed to grieve.
You had to help everybody.
I had to take care of other people.
Yeah. All you care about is your daughter. You don't want to have to care about somebody injuring themselves, somebody trying to throw themselves out a window. It really didn't allow you to process that.
No. I mean, and I have, I think, since then, but it took a while. But so that all happened. So now we have to deal with the next day or the day after. It was a day or two. It wasn't immediate. They had a meeting. It was in a private room with the team. Now, at this point, after Annie had gotten to this point, the Beijing hospital became very professional to a certain level, which was a little bit comforting. I didn't feel like I was – we finally got to this point, which was too late, obviously.
Yeah.
Or fate. I mean, maybe nothing could have helped. Let me take a little side note on that, too. I don't know if I should stick it in here or not. But you know how all this happened in China with all the hospitals I just mentioned and all the incompetency and all the crazy stuff and maybe lack of experience and everything?
Mm-hmm.
That would not have happened because of this. And this haunts me to this day. My sister, the person I love the most in my whole life, other than my wife, she's had ovarian cancer for years. And it had finally gotten to the point in the beginning of 2012 where, you know, she knew she was going to pass on. She only had months to live. I said, you know, Debbie, what can I do to help you? What's your dream? You know, what can I do? You know, and we talked a lot on the phone. And she said, you know, I want to go with my grandkids to Disney World. I said, okay, I'll make that happen for you. Sent her money to go to Disney World, stay at the Polynesian, you know, all that stuff. It was like $6,000, $5,000. I can't remember. But it was enough for her to have airplane tickets, the trip, rent a car, all that stuff to do this. This trip was scheduled for, I think it was May 31st, 2012. Now, of course, I had not been back to America. And my wife and I had at least planned to go back to America with my wife and my daughter to go to Disney World to see my sister. But there was some fighting in my marriage. One of the ways that it was dealt with on my wife's side was that she decided she wasn't going to go. So we didn't go. When I look back on that today, and, you know, hindsight is 20/20, if we had gone, we would have certainly been in America for 3 months if we came back. We probably would have come back the middle of May. We would have been in America for June when Annie got really sick. We would have been in America for July when Annie died. If you look at the statistics for what Annie's problem was, which is supposedly juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, overseas, outside of America, the mortality rate for this is about 25% or so. In America, it's 4. So it's another one of these things that, you know, haunt me. And like when I mentioned about the Starbucks thing, you know, I said, oh, I got a coffee and a sandwich at the airport.
5 minutes.
Right, 5 minutes. But see, now I look back on that and I'm like, maybe that 5 minutes would have made a difference at the hospital. I mean, who knows? Who knows what time frame would have changed if that 5 minutes was not taken by me getting a coffee and a sandwich?
Maybe you would have been number 50 and something.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there's just, you know, that's the thing. When you have an event like this happen later on in life, you know, you examine everything and try to find out what you did wrong, what the reason, you know, what could have been different. You know, I mean, one of the things is that, you know, as a parent, you know, you sort of feel like you have one job, and that's to keep your children safe and healthy. And if you fail to do that, you question everything about yourself to the core.
You have to. You have to second guess it, because you have to think, what did I do wrong? Because this happened under my watch. And so, I remember you mentioning the bribe to the one doctor, the red bag bribe.
Right.
And you were like, did I not give him enough? Was it because I was a foreigner? Or maybe it was because he didn't know what was wrong, and he would have felt wrong taking your money because he couldn't have done anything. Who knows?
Right. And there was some talk about him bringing in his mentor or whatever. And that actually did happen at the end. And the mentor was actually stumped too in Qingdao. But, you know, if I had given him 10 times or 20 times the amount that I offered him, maybe he would have done, you know, this extra effort. Maybe he would have helped us coordinate transportation, you know, instead of the way we had to do it. I'm sure, you know, driving in the car for many hours and then taking an airplane flight was not good for Annie.
No.
You know, I'm sure it wasn't ideal. I go back and I wonder, should I have given him more money? Should I have offered him more money? You know, should I have gone to the hospital administrators and offered money? What should I have done to make her priority one, at least for a short period of time?
But you don't even know, though, that if you would have bribed this guy more, if he would have done anything, if you would have gone to the hospital administrators, if they would have helped at all. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know how they would have responded. It's, you want to make her priority one. I get that. But what does that entail in this crazy backwards culture of trying to get from point A to point B?
Well, and you're right. See, at that point, we didn't know that she was in danger of dying. We didn't know that it was supposedly juvenile rheumatoid arthritis with a 25% mortality rate outside of the U.S. We didn't know this. We thought it was infection.
Allergies.
We thought it was something benign, relatively benign. So, I mean, so you're right. For me to go back and second guess myself on, you know, getting the coffee or not paying the guy enough money or taking the car and the airplane or all the other little things that came up, it's all 2020. So it's so easy. But when you're in the middle of it, you're just trying to do the best you can. But as a parent, as someone who loses, you know, my sunshine, that's what I used to call her, you can't help, at least for some time after this all goes down. I'm better now than I was, mm-hmm. But it's 4.5 years later. You can't help to question everything. Everything.
No. No, you can't.
You know, to continue on with the stuff at the hospital, so she's in pediatric intensive care. You know, she'd been declared by them brain dead. So the way that they declared this was by doing a carotid ultrasound, which is an ultrasound on the neck, and checking the blood flow to the brain, and by checking her pupil response and some other, like poking her with needles and doing the chest pressing on her sternum and things like that. That's how they wanted to declare her brain dead. So I didn't accept that. I told him, I said, you know, and this is probably wrong, but I said, I'm not going to let you declare her brain dead until you do an EEG, something that measures, or maybe I'm getting the acronyms mixed up, but do a brain scan, I guess is what I should say.
Yeah.
To see if there's any activity. They said to me, well, we can't move her, and that machine's in another building.
Why can't they move her?
So there, I'm saying, so you want me to remove my daughter's breathing tube and whatever without doing that test? And they're like, yeah, we can't move her. I said, you know what? You're going to move her. Or you're going to move the machine, I'm sorry, is what I said. And I said, we can't do that. They said, we can't do that. I said, no, you're going to do it. So I think you've probably already heard me say a couple times where I sort of had to be an asshole sometimes in China.
Yeah.
And the reason I had to be an asshole is because I had to deal with fucking assholes.
Yeah.
Okay? And the only thing that I could threaten them with is with causing trouble or embarrassing them or, you know, making them look stupid. I mean, it's all I could do. So it's like, you know, I'm like, I don't care that your machine's in another building. You need to move it. So they did. Took them a day or so and they moved it. And, you know, it was legit. I mean, I don't know a lot about these machines, but it certainly looked like the proper machine and it was hooked up to her head and it showed, you know, what I would expect. They left it on her for 2 days and, you know, there was pretty much nothing. So that's when I could accept that she was brain dead with the clinical signs, like I mentioned, and a test of some sort.
But who knows if all the other treatments she'd received up until this point contributed to this final stroke?
Yeah, I mean, like the IV aspirin and all that, who knows? You know, if it really is juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, you know, the outcome of that, you know, if you don't die. So she had the systemic type. So what it is, your immune system attacks your joints in your body. That's the regular juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. So the systemic style, your immune system attacks your organs. Mm-hmm. So it attacks your liver, your heart, your spleen, you know, all these organs in your body. And when this happens, you know, obviously your organs are damaged, but it also causes issues with your blood, makes your blood very thick. That's most likely the reason why she stroked out. Mm-hmm. So, but
it, all those things kind of make sense now looking at a lot of her symptoms with the sediment and the other problems she was having. So,
right. So then of course, we find out that she's really brain dead, or at best that I can know. And then now we kick into, you know, how can we make this a good thing? So we try to find out how to donate her organs. And they checked into that. It was pretty quick. And they pretty much said, you know, with all of the medication she's been on and the damage, they can't use anything. They can only use one thing, her corneas. So we had a meeting with the eye harvesting people, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And they came over. They explained the procedure to us. Basically, they were going to take her eyeballs out. They would put some glass in there. If the corneas were okay, then Annie could help somebody else see. Before they did that, we had to remove her her tube.
Well, so after they get this machine and you've found out that she truly is brain dead and you're the one that is doing all the troubleshooting to verify this to your satisfaction, then you have to make that decision of what you want to do with Annie.
But then the next step, even before they can do that, is that we have to remove her tube. She was intubated.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had to remove her breathing tube.
Yeah. From life support, pretty much.
Right. I don't know how this happens in America. I don't. I asked around and I haven't gotten a straight answer from anybody. But the way it happened with us is that we went into the pediatric ICU. My wife and I held her in our arms at the same time. Together, we pulled the tube out. I don't know how it happens in America, but that's how it happened there.
I think if you requested to do it in America, they might allow you, but no, normally it's not the parents that do that.
So it was pretty much a gasp or two, but we were told that that was fake. And then, you know, that was it. Then we put her back in her bed or whatever, and we left, and then they came and did the cornea thing. And actually, we left the hospital and we went to the local Buddhist temple. So now, you know, we're like 5-6 hour drive away from our house. We really didn't have a way to get Annie back to our hometown. We inquired into that, you know, can we have her transported? And we were told, you know, there's no refrigerated way to do that. So this is, you know, the beginning of July, middle July. This is on the 14th of July that we pulled the tube out on Annie. So it was pretty hot. So we went to the local Buddhist temple, and it was like a couple hours later, she showed up in a van. It was, of course, was not refrigerated. And they opened the door up and transferred her to a stainless steel stretcher. No, it was actually pretty nice. I mean, so what I mean by that is they had her in a paper mache, like coffin.
Okay.
that was actually very beautiful. And we did open it and looked inside, even though we were a little scared because of the eyeball part. But they had her really looking beautiful in a white, angelic, like white gown. I was impressed. That was really something we needed, the way that they did that for us.
So they showed more respect for the dead.
Yeah, in a way. You know, I mean, you know, and I, like I said, once she got into pediatric ICU, there was a level of professionalism. There was a level. There was people that cared. We could tell. There was people that cried with us. Things like that happened. It was just that when we first got to the hospital, it was so, you know, the queue and the people waiting in the rain, you know, so there was a big difference between the two, you know. But she was there at the crematorium in the casket in a white dress. She looked beautiful. Now we're going to get her cremated. So I talked to the crematorium guy. I said, you know, we'd like the ashes back. And he says, well, there's not going to be any. And I said, what? She says, she's too small. So I said to him, I said, well, can we put some fruit in there? And he liked fruit. We'll go buy some bananas. We'll go fill it up with things she likes, snacks, that kind of stuff, to give it some mass to end up with some ashes. And, you know, that's not going to work. It's because it's the bone, you know. So unless you're going to put meat in there with bone, you're not going to have any ashes. Basically, they were going to, you know, they wanted to cremate her with really nothing to walk away with. No proof she was going to be cremated. What do you mean? What am I talking about? Proof she's going to be cremated? Well, I live in China for 10 years. So just because you drop off a deceased relative at a crematorium and expect that that is going to happen and that the body is not going to be redirected for some other use, if you think that, that there is not a chance that that would be the case, you're an idiot.
The hospital's already said her organs can't be used for anything. Yet.
No, but I mean, for like studies, for, you know, who knows what.
Yeah, but just the simple fact that this could happen, they could redirect her. They could unknowingly try to use her organs somewhere else. They could unknowingly just sell her for whatever
skin
reason.
Or who knows what. I don't know. Just, you know, just for a school or for, you know, Annie was unique. When she went out in public, she drew a crowd. You know, she was beautiful, you know, blondish hair with very white skin. She was tall. She didn't look Chinese at all. She had a Chinese mother and a Caucasian American father. I mean, she drew a crowd wherever she went, even in 2012. Mm-hmm. Like I used to draw a crowd in 2002 when I ate food. She still drew one in 2012, 2011. So, but it was like, I'm sorry. I need to see this happen. Looking back on this, I'm happy I did. But it caused some problems with me. You know, they disagreed. And I said, no, I said, you're going to have to figure out a way for me to do this.
You want to watch the actual...
Right. It's the only way I could know that she's not being redirected. It's the only way I could know finally in the end where she was in the end. Because if I didn't do that, I would always wonder.
So here you are being an asshole again to cause trouble to get your way.
Right. This took a little while, and they finally came back and said, you know, I could go in, follow her into the crematorium on the little cart, pushed her down the hallways to the door, put her on the conveyor belt. It's sort of like a roller belt that goes into the fire. Mm-hmm. I can see the fire inside. So we moved her onto the rollers. It was pretty much as I expected. And then we pushed her into the rollers, and as she got to the end, I'm expecting her to stay flat. Mm-hmm. But as she got to the end, the casket tips up on end and falls in, which means that instead of her being cremated, you know, in a laying on her back or whatever, in a peaceful kind of like posture,
her whole body
was,
drops.
Yeah, that freaked me out a little bit. You know, and to be honest with you, for a year or two after that, I couldn't, if I looked at a fire, not really on a stovetop or anything like that, but something bigger, mm-hmm. like a campfire or something, it was tough for me, but I'm past that now.
But you just had this image replaying in your head. This.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I imagined if she'd go in there flat and peaceful with her arms crossed or whatever, and, you know, the flames would just come around her and she would find, you know, that's what I imagined. I didn't imagine her tipping up on end and all scrunching down to the bottom of whatever, you know, the casket and falling into this pit. That's not the way I had it in my mind. So it was a shock. And I went outside and my wife and I walked, you know, some meters away from the crematorium, and we waited for the smoke to come. And after a minute or two, there was black smoke that lasted 5 minutes, maybe. And then it was over. And of course we went in and asked, is there any ash? And they said, no. And we left.
My wife is a big dog lover, and we have dogs, you know, they pass every 10 to 15 years, and we're able to get the ashes of our dogs back when we have them cremated. Our dogs that way.
Yeah, I understand. I don't know why.
Yeah.
That's why I really didn't. I mean, I'm at the crematorium, you know, I can't remember if I tried to Google or anything or something like that or find out, but that's why I had to see it. Cause I was like, this just doesn't seem right. How can there be no ashes?
Maybe there's other ashes in there and they don't want to mix them and give you mixed ash. I don't even know, but they could have given you something, anything.
We would have been happy with a thumbnail.
Yeah.
Full, you know, I mean, just something that we could bring back and put, you know, by her mother's house and, you know, by the apple farm and,
yeah,
or take to the sea. Any love the sea. We left with nothing. And it bothers my wife to this day. She's like, you know, she wants to be where Annie is. We have to go back to Beijing. Mm-hmm. So after Annie passed, we went back to our home. You know, it was very difficult. And I took all of Annie's things and put everything in her bedroom. So I had to search the house from top to bottom, find every crayon, everything, move it where my wife couldn't see it. We actually only stayed there a couple hours, and then we went to my mother-in-law's house because my wife just couldn't deal with it. So, but at least we got the house to the point where it was cleaned up a little bit and Annie's stuff wasn't everywhere. I mean, you know, a 2.5-year-old, you know, they have stuff everywhere. So now as far as the reaction afterwards, it was also rather strange. You know, Annie was a sweetheart, you know, in the village, in like my mother-in-law's village. It's a small village that's like it's like in a valley surrounded by high mountains on each side. And up the sides of the mountains on each side is apple trees. Mm-hmm. Down in the middle of the valley is this village. There's a stream that runs through it. It's very beautiful. It's a close-knit community. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody's an apple farmer. Everybody. They're all peasants. Mm-hmm.
So everybody knows each other's business. Everybody knows what's going on. Small town.
Exactly. When we went back, just even a couple of days after Annie passed away, to the village, her name was taboo. You couldn't speak it. You know, in the past, I had bought pictures and given it to different family members, aunts and uncles and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they were gone. Usually in everybody's house in China, in a peasant's house, it's common to have like a big mirror that like covers the whole wall. Mm-hmm. And on this mirror, they put different sayings or pictures, family pictures and things like that. And, you know, prior to her passing, you know, there was pictures, you know, on the mirror and so on. But after she passed, they were gone. It was almost like she never existed. And that is still the way it is today.
What would happen
5 years later?
When you would talk to some of these people and tell them about what happened?
Well, that was a tough thing because, so I'm going to give you the obvious. My family in America, totally supportive, not judgmental. Showing grief, showing concern, supporting me.
Sympathy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Sympathy, everything. Chinese friend and family, they would call her up, ask for the details. What happened? So that's not too bad, right? But ask, you know, what happened at the hospital, you know, tell me this story, whatever. But then they would come up with ideas why it happened. And they were generally because we did something wrong. So, for example, you know, I think Annie had this because you guys had cats. Or I think Annie had this because there was some bad food that you were giving her. Did you let Annie eat ice cream? Or, oh, I know that you guys like to go to the pizza place. Pizza isn't good for kids. You shouldn't give pizza to kids. Or that sandbox you had, it's from the sandbox. Or guinea pigs, it's from the guinea pigs. Or, you know, you should have gone to Beijing sooner. Or, you know, we didn't know that it was a big problem until the end. So, I mean, all the kinds of things that we questioned ourselves, you know, that's what they would come back with. And, you know, so generally they would get off, my wife would get off the phone with these people and she'd be in tatters. She'd be like, you know, they just told me it was my fault.
They're victim blaming. They're telling you there's no rhyme or reason at this point, but they're trying to find out through whatever weird cultural folklore why your daughter's passed away, and in questioning your decisions and your life. It's just wrong.
Well, you know, some people are going to get angry with me for saying this. You know, I think there is a place, for example, like Chinese medicine, okay, in the world. Okay, I get it. It's been around for thousands and thousands of years. But you have to understand that, you know, you're dealing with a culture that thinks that because grapes look like the lungs, you should eat grapes if you have a lung problem. I mean, there's a simplicity to, especially when you get to a level of a peasant or people that don't have education. I mean, there's a big difference on the education level between America and China. And I'm not saying there's a lot of very intelligent people. Yes, I definitely have friends that are very intelligent. But the majority of people in China are not educated. And they have a lot of superstition, misconceptions. And sometimes it's easy to buy into these things because, you know, you're looking for an answer.
You yeah. even bought into it. Your goldfish died. You fell through a manhole. You're perceiving this as bad omens because you're the culture's rubbing off on you. I totally understand why you perceive it. I mean, we can sit back and be like, that's just bad luck, man. But I can understand why you're buying into it while it's happening, while it's going down.
And even, you know, like in China, there's like every 12 years is a special time in your life. So, you know, when you're born, then 12 years later, then when you're 24, then when you're 36, then when you're 48, and so on. And, you know, this happened on my 12th year. You know, my wife has already gone to my past and looked at my past. And, well, I'm going to tell you, when I was 12 years old, I was molested by a Boy Scout leader. Affected my life greatly. At 24, I had my mother passed away. And so on. So, you know, it's easy to buy into this stuff when you're looking for answers.
Yeah, when you're making these connections, definitely.
Right. So the family, it's like Annie never existed. I still cannot mention Annie's name in front of my mother-in-law. She's actually here in America right now helping us with one of my sons. We've had two kids since Annie passed. Thank God. It's been a big help. We had a boy in 2014 and another boy in 2016. I'm also happy that they're both boys, because I think if we had a girl, when my wife thought that, you know, when we first got pregnant with Nathan, okay, my oldest, mm-hmm. you know, she was hoping he was a girl. And of course she wanted to name him Annie, you know, in some ways I think it's a blessing. We have two boys now, but my wife and I really have only been able to talk about her in the last year or so.
Did your wife behave the same way? Did she act like Annie never existed?
No, not really. But okay. I mean, yeah, because you couldn't mention her name. You couldn't look at her pictures. You couldn't. The Itsy Bitsy Spider, you know, one of Annie's songs, that could not be listened to. Cucumbers were a problem. Annie liked cucumbers. I mean, it's just there was a lot of things that, to answer your question, was it like she never existed? No, it wasn't like that. It was like she just... to exclude anything that would remind my wife of Annie. And that's one of the reasons we're in America now. Because being in China, there's too many memories, especially our hometown. To mention, in counseling, if you have a death of a child or anything like this in your life, it's going to take you some time to find somebody that's going to really help. It's valuable. It works. Mm-hmm. And it takes time. You know, my wife, I think I mentioned that we didn't come to America because of pet fighting in our marriage. So after Annie had passed away, you know, I stuck with her, and I guess she stuck with me. And we've gone to a lot of counseling, mm-hmm. including couples counseling, and we're closer now than we were before. So like some people will say to me, from bad things, good things can happen. I can't really think of too many good things that really happened from all this, but I can tell you that I'm closer to my wife now than I ever was.
You went through something traumatic. I mean, as much as that can crush you and crush a relationship, now you've been through it.
Well, and it's strange because, and I guess it's a misconception, is that when a couple loses a child, that they have a really high divorce rate. And there was actually a study like in the 70s or something like that, that indicated it was like 90% or some really high number. You know, they've done studies in the meantime, and it turns out that actually couples that go through a tragic loss like this actually have a lower divorce rate than the norm. You know, as low as like 16% compared to, you know, 40 or 50 for the average couple. You know, that grieving together, and also the part where the couple knows that at some level that if they stay together, that the memory of the child is maintained. I am grateful for that part of this.
There was some things that stuck out to me about when you spoke about your daughter. You were talking about the way she looked, her hair, the things she liked. Is there anything that you want to talk about as far as her and her personality? And
sure, should have done that. So, you know, I mean, Annie loved books. So I used to go to the bookstore. I used to buy books at the bookstore, buy them through Amazon and so on. And we used to spend a lot of time reading books together. And it's a little bit weird because, see, here's the thing. So she lives in China. Mother speaks Chinese. Her grandmother speaks Chinese. Everybody around her speaks Chinese. I'm the only one that speaks English. And I'm the only one that reads to her. And Annie spoke English. She didn't speak Chinese.
Crazy. But yeah.
You know, so it was because we used to read books. We used to take care of the pets together, take care of the guinea pig, you know, all these things. We used to, you know, my wife and so on did a lot of stuff with Annie too. But Annie would listen and understand Chinese, but verbalization was in English, which I thought was, you know, just a little bit maybe telling that we were really close. She enjoyed, you know, we lived across the street from a shopping mall. And, you know, her favorite thing was to go over there, you know, obviously with us, and go to the makeup department. Right? And she'd sit on the chair in the makeup department and, you know, put makeup on. I guess thinking, you know, here's the crazy thing about this, okay? So I just told you the story about the makeup, right? And then the first thing that enters my mind is, wow, that's dirty. Maybe that's where this came from.
Yeah. You're second guessing again.
And I'm jumping around a little bit, but this is what happens today. Like with my sons, a cold is a threat. A fever is a threat. Throwing up is a threat. A rash is a threat. You know, so before Annie passed, oh, you know, she has a cold, she'll be fine. Oh, she has a little bit of a rash, she'll be fine. Or any child, yeah. Right? But now every medical indication of anything is a threat. And I'll be honest with you. We're at the pediatrician's office at least once a week for one or the other of my kids. And, you know, I try to keep it under control, but my wife, she likes to be there. If my son throws up more than, you know, a couple times, we're there. He's got a fever of 100, you know, 0.0, we're there.
And your doctor probably thinks that you're a helicopter parent that's overreacting.
No, she doesn't. She knows everything.
Okay, good.
Our doctor is really cool. She's like the best. And she knows about Annie. She helped us get our oldest son screened for juvenile rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune disorders. She gets it. Sometimes, like, I just had to go to the hospital last night with my youngest because he couldn't stop coughing. And, you know, we called the pediatrician. The pediatrician said, take him to the hospital. Fine. You know, when I go to the hospital, you know, what's going on? Da, 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 and I'll tell them. And then I'll tell the people at the hospital, say, you know, I said, I just want you to know, we had a daughter that was 2.5 years old that passed away a couple years ago. So we're sort of hyper vigilant. And they get it. Nobody's ever given us any trouble. They're really understanding.
And you know, you're in America too, where children and health is important.
You know, but I'm better. You know, this is what I'm saying. This is like it's like this process and getting through this. And it's like this cloud. There's like a cloud over my life now. It's been thicker before. It's better now, but it paints everything from my kids being sick to a memory to, you know, buying a coffee at Starbucks, to seeing a fire, to eating a cucumber, to looking at the moon. My daughter loved the moon. To memory, everything. It's just like this cloud. And it's bizarre. And it's painful. But the thing is, it's to try to remember the good things.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about the good things that are hard. Is that, and I don't know, I didn't make this up. This didn't come from me. But somebody explained the death of a loved one this way. You know, your loved one is a painting. It's like if you set the painting out in the yard and it snows and you remember the paint, you know, you initially remember the painting very well, But as there's more and more snow that builds up on this painting, you can't remember the details, and you remember more, you forget more and more about what it was like, what this person was like. And that's sort of what I go through with Annie, is that to really remember about her, I have to really concentrate and think, because, and maybe it's my own choice by mistake, but you know, it's easy for me to remember the painful things. The joyful things I have to really think about, like, you know, dancing the hokey pokey with her, or
singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider with her.
Right, right. Or, you know, one time she got this Christmas gift. It was like two things that you can bang together. And then she took a bag of potato chips and proceeded to like pulverize the whole bag of potato chips with it. You know, things like this. Or her first Christmas, you know, when she came out of the door and saw her tree for the first time when she was, you know, just over two. You know, she was a really cool kid. She was really friendly. And I miss her, you know. But I have these two boys now. You know, like I sort of mentioned before, is that before we had my two sons now, I was not scared to die, because I said to myself, you know, if I pass away, I almost wanted to die. You know, if I pass away, I'll see her again. I welcomed it. I was like, you know, yeah, at least I'll be able to see her again. But now, you know, I have these two little kids. I understand, you know, I'm 52, and if my sons are 3 years and 3 months. So if I were to pass away now, you know, I might get my wish, possibly, who knows, to see Annie again. But then my two little boys would be without a father, and that would be tragic. You know, it's tough to try to figure out. I'm just babbling now.
No, you're not. You're just putting together how this has impacted you. And like any of us, when we have something, some major event, it changes us. It changes everything we do, the way we see the world. But hopefully, with time and understanding, it won't define us and who we are. It's just part of us. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's slowly where I'm getting to. Before, it did define me. Mm-hmm. And now it's, you know, even doing this podcast, I said to myself, why am I doing this? I mean, what's going to come from this? Why? What's the positive thing of doing this? You know, it's part of a process.
Yeah.
And 2 years ago, it wouldn't have been the right time.
It's just everything you have to process. And from what you said, you weren't even able to process it when it happened, because you were having to deal with everybody else. You were having to deal with paying bills, getting transportation. You weren't even able to take in what was happening as it was happening. So now in the aftermath, you're literally grieving and dealing with the stress and the trauma after the fact, because you weren't even able to process it while it was happening. It just sounds like you were sort of deadened at that moment and just went into autopilot. Now you're able to look back and understand and even talk about it.
Right. And like before Annie passed, I was my wife was abusive to me. So during this time, you know, Annie saw a lot of crazy stuff. And so after Annie passed away, all my friends are like, you got to leave this woman. She's not good to you. She's hit you. She whatever. And, you know, that's when I told him, I said, I can't go. I have to take care of her. She was such a basket case afterwards. And a lot of her response to all this was lashing out at me, blaming it on me. You know, it's because you had fucking guinea pigs or whatever. And,
and most men would have turned and left. Most lesser men would have been gone.
I couldn't go. So then after 6 months, she was better. And I still hadn't really processed anything. So I'd lost my job because I used to, you know, I had to take care of her. I went from making 200 and something thousand dollars a year to 12, literally. So this happened, you know, July of 2012. So January of 2013, my wife hit me again or whatever. And I told her, I said, you have to stop. You can't do it anymore, or I'm going to have to go. And she said she would. We came back to America, and it did continue. Finally, she didn't have any friends. So I went to a church here and found some Chinese friends, you know, had the kind of, hopefully the kind of morals that I thought might help her. She became friends with them. And she also started going to counseling because that was one of the things I said I really needed her to do. Things got better, but didn't really improve that much. And then January of 2016, I'm driving in the car, and she beats the crap out of me when I'm driving in the car. And I pulled over, and I called the cops. And she was arrested for domestic violence, endangering the welfare of a child and everything because my son was in the car. So she had to go through all the court stuff and whatever. And it was all reduced to violations because if it stayed higher than that, she might be deported. So I had to pay a lawyer. And it's funny, I had to pay both sides of it, you know, it was crazy. But
yeah.
Got everything reduced to violations. We found a really great counselor, marriage counselor. The guy gives a shit. I mean, he'll like send me texts out of the blue. How you doing? Send text to her. We still have our problems today, but they're a lot better. We have our boys. I'm back to making money again, but my health is bad. My health has gone way downhill in the last 4 years. My doctor says it's from stress, and it could be from being on the receiving side of an abusive relationship. It could be from my daughter dying. It could be from a lot of things.
It's all of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm on an insulin pump now. I have a really bad sleep disorder. I'm a really bad insomnia because, you know, I lay down at night and all this shit goes through my head. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
But my wife is better.
You're working on it, man.
Well, and that's sort of what matters to me because, you know, she's got to take care of my kids. She's 30 and I'm 52. And she's the one that's going to be here later. I need her to be, you know, to be able to do that. Yeah. So but that's about it, Justin. I don't know. I mean, you know, there is some good that came out of this.
Yeah.
You know, for example, my wife has an idea at least about a higher power. I mean, Justin, you know, I mean, I've listened to enough of your shit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the whole God thing and everything, it could be a bunch of bullshit. Who knows? But, you know, I mean,
it helps some people. Gives some people hope, and that's all that matters.
Right. Well, and some idea of a higher power, because, I mean, Justin, you must be the same as me. You know, if you go out and you look at a beautiful sunset or something like that, how did this happen? You know, is it God? Is it Jesus? I don't know if I buy into that either, but is it mathematics? It could be. I don't know. You know, I mean, but there's something, you know, did all the fish die for a reason? No, it's probably because, you know, the heater broke or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
it's one of those things where you have to put order to chaos and we have to believe in something. Even if it's mathematics, you got to have something there.
You can see the kind of person I am. If I go to a meeting, I want to agenda. I want to be prepared for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I like order, or I can't deal with it. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing with Annie, I mean, here's the thing. My whole life, I could fix everything. I mean, from the point up to the day that Annie died, if I had a problem, and I don't care what it was, a traffic ticket, a problem with a contractor working on my house, a problem with a computer, I could fix it.
The New York is bleeding through.
Yeah.
You know.
But you know, so then this happened and I couldn't fix this. Mm-hmm. And then I've come to realize, you know what, there's a lot. I can't fix my diabetes. There's a lot of things I can't fix. I'm like, I'm older now. I can't. Wow. Is this what being old is? Is that you can't fix things?
Yeah.
You can't push through problems. You don't have the energy. You don't have creative thinking that's needed to fix problems. This was the first problem in my whole life that I couldn't fix. That's one of the biggest issues for me. Why couldn't I fix this? And my daughter died. So
I think you did everything in your power that was humanly possible. And I don't think bribing a doctor or not getting the Starbucks or anything like that would have changed a thing.
And the whole Starbucks thing is like last night, my wife wanted to take my son to the hospital, which is a total false alarm. Fine. I didn't eat anything. So I'm like, if we're going to be there for several hours, we should stop and get something. So we stopped at McDonald's, you know, crap food, but whatever. The drive-thru was filled up with people. So it took longer than expected. My son's in the back seat. He's fine. Right. But the whole time I'm in the drive-thru, I'm like, this is taking too long. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be going right to the hospital because I never know what's going to happen. Is my taking away 10 minutes that I shouldn't? You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. No.
So, I mean, it's crazy.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe to make yourself feel better, go to the hospital first or go wherever you need to go first. And while you're sitting in that lobby, while you're sitting in that waiting room, and maybe then you can go get your McDonald's. Maybe that's the compromise,
no,
you know?
No, you're right. No, so then I, you know, then I'm like, am I being selfish? Am I shouldn't be, you know? Yeah. So I don't know.
Everything is just questioned now. It's sad because you shouldn't have to think about that.
Well, thanks a lot. No problem. Thanks for letting me get it down someplace. I really appreciate it.
No problem, man. Thank you so much for sharing. It's an incredible story.